All right, well, thanks, Paul, for having me here, and also to the other organizers for putting this workshop together. So what I'll be telling you about a little bit this morning is pseudopotentials for interacting dipoles. And I think generally the talk will be very simple because the dipoles we are considering are really point particles. So we really simplify the problem tremendously from the outset. So here's an outline of my talk. What I like to start off this is just tell you a little bit about S-wave pseudopotentials. And tell you how to apply S-wave pseudopotentials to 2 and 3 trapped atoms. And the idea here is that can sort of motivate why pseudopotentials may actually be useful. And I also point out how pseudopotentials can be used to do some many-body physics. And then I move on to dipolar pseudopotentials, and I look at 2 types of pseudopotentials, a finite-range pseudopotential and a zero-range pseudopotentials. So to start with, you might ask, well, why do we use pseudopotentials? And generally speaking, it makes our life easier, at least in certain cases. And we know this, say, from electronic structure calculations, where we also use pseudopotentials, which effectively account for all the inner shell physics. But in this context of cold atoms, oftentimes the pseudopotentials allow us to do things analytically. So some few-body calculations become tractable, and also some many-body calculations become tractable, or at least simplify. Of course, there are also reasons why one may not want to use pseudopotentials. And one of the reasons might be that some details of the interactions get lost, and or may be difficult to put in. And the other reason might be that, well, things are possibly solvable if you use a pseudopotential, but the math actually is pretty nasty. So one has to sort of think about how big is the gain that one gets from the pseudopotentials. So dipoles are anisotropic and have long-range interactions. So if we consider aligned dipoles, this is the long-range behavior here. And so one of the questions that I'll be coming to throughout this talk is really if we have a long-range interaction and an anisotropy, how can we actually put this into a zero-range contact potential? And again, throughout this talk, I assume that the dipoles are aligned and that they're simple point particles. So it's really the simplest sort of description of dipoles that you can imagine. So let me start off very simple with the S-wave pseudopotential. And, you know, the starting point is some up initio atom-atom potential, and we've heard about these potentials from a couple of people. And then typically one does a coupled channel calculation for this atom-atom potential, and one gets the phase shifts, and the phase shifts can be energy dependent. And we've seen throughout this talk that depending on the type of system you're looking at, we may actually need quite a few partial waves that are coupled. And now the idea is to construct a zero-range pseudopotential, in this case an S-wave potential, that actually reproduces the S-wave scattering lengths of the full potential. So it's a one-parameter description. This is the S-wave scattering lengths here, and to start with, one might actually neglect this energy dependence of the scattering lengths here. So it's really taking the tangent of the phase shift divided by k with the minus sign in the limit that the scattering energy goes to zero. So there's a prefactor here that gives us the scattering strengths of the pseudopotential. Then there's this delta function that simply makes the pseudopotential zero range. And then there's this operator here, and this operator is nothing but a sort of regularization operator that basically cures the divergence and pulls out the right power of the regular function. So this is basically to make everything well behaved. The pseudopotential itself, without the regularization operator, goes back to Fermi, maybe even further. And then the regularization operator was introduced by Yang Yang in 1957. So, for our purposes, it's a useful thing to think about as well is, instead of thinking about this functional form of the pseudopotential, one can simply think about a boundary condition. So what this pseudopotential does, in essence, is it poses a boundary condition on the wave function, and this boundary condition depends on the S-wave scattering length. So maybe if I don't know if you can see this here. And so this is my R coordinate, and this picture actually goes back to what Paul was doing in his Blackboard lunch talk. If I have the realistic atom-atom wave function, it may look something like this. And now the idea of the pseudopotential is to take the outside solution and simply say we don't really care about all these inner wiggles here, and we simply say we replace, okay, I should come in like this, we replace this by a boundary condition here in such a way that the outside solution agrees with the full scattering solution. That's really what the pseudopotential does.
Scattering length, even in the two-body problem, your solutions are no longer orthogonal. They're only orthogonal when the S-wave, when the scattering length there is energy independent. Now, on the two-body problem, that may not be an issue unless maybe you're calculating matrix elements or something like that. But in the many-body problem, that actually, as far as I know, can cause problems. I know in the three-body problem, it can. That can be an issue.
Yeah, I mean,
at the, you can't just sort of lightly just include the energy dependence there and expect it to work. There's actually some problems.
No, so I mean, I can certainly do this at the two-body level, and I can say, right, I mean, I pick some scattering energy, and sort of physically it certainly makes sense. If I have a many-body sample, the two particles may not scatter at zero energy, but at a finite energy, and so I can sort of think about that scattering process happening at that energy, and that should give me a better description. And for two particles, I'm going to show you that it works. In certain applications, but yeah, but I think you have a very good point, maybe phrasing it a little bit differently. If you do go to the three-body problem, one of the questions that you have to address is this K in here, that's a two-body scattering energy or a two-body energy. In the three-body problem, the quantity that you have is your three-body energy. And so you have to sort of decide somehow how your three-body energy divides into this two-body energy at which the particles collide and the extra energy. And I think that's just a different way of addressing the orthogonality of the wave functions that you're talking about.
That's a different question, because, I mean, the non-orthogonality is a fundamental problem. And what it leads to is non-zero asymptotic coupling. The coupling doesn't go away. This is something, for instance, Joe Masek found when he was doing the P-wave stuff for fermions.
So even in the two-body problem, if you added a trap, wouldn't this cause problems? Like if you say, use this interaction and just wanted to find the spectrum of particles in the trap, wouldn't you already start running into these non-orthogonality issues to solve that?
Well, so for the two-body problem, I can maybe show the next two slides, and then we can discuss that further, but maybe just to sort of illustrate how that energy dependence works in the two-body problem, I go forward. So if we have this S-wave pseudopotential, we want to do something with it. And what we and other people have looked at is to say, let's put two particles in the trap. The trap is harmonic, in this case, spherically symmetric. And so we separate off the center of mass motion, and then what Bush and Al found in this 1998 paper is that if you use that zero range interaction, you actually get a nice transcendental eigenequation. And for the moment, if you want, just set this S-wave scattering length here to a constant of your choice. Fine. If you do this and then you plot the eigenspectrum, this is how it looks like. So the way I've plotted it here is these are the relative two-body energies as a function of 1 over the S-wave scattering length. So the strongly interacting regime is now in the center here, and the weakly interacting regime is sides. Thanks to myself. So, you know, just to discuss the spectrum a tiny bit, the S-wave pseudopotential we know has a bound state in free space if the scattering length is positive, and this is sort of the resemblance of that two-body bound state here. The trap simply pushes that binding energy up a little bit. And then these dashed states here is what we would think of as the quantized energy scattering continuum. So in free space, we would just have the continuum, but because we put the system in a trap, we have a quantization, and how the levels look like in the trap is really determined by that S-wave scattering length. So this is no energy dependence. Now you might say, well, you know, this is very nice, but how does this compared to something a bit more realistic? So realistic, that's the actual, say, interaction between two atoms, say, between two alkalis. And so basically what I'm showing here is, again, the two-body energy spectrum now as a function of the S-wave scattering lengths. And essentially what we're doing is we keep the two-body potential fixed, but we change the confinement and make it tighter. And what we have is, let's look at this Lewis manifold here first. We have three curves in this Lewis manifold. The Lewis curve here, the solid line, that's just the pseudopotential without energy dependence. And then one of these upper curves here is actually the energy level in the trap for two particles interacting through a realistic potassium potential. So it's a single channel calculation, but it's a triplet potential curve. So this potassium potential has many bound states. And so we just look at the states that are above the, so it's basically the quantized energy continuum. And then there's a second curve on top of here, and that second curve comes from including the energy dependence in the scattering lengths. And so what you see is that by including that energy dependence self-consistently, that was done in these works over here, you really find that the pseudopotential provides a very good description as long as the van der Waals length is not so much, or it's relatively small compared to the oscillator length. This arrow here indicates a 4% deviation between these two curves. And then down here, we just did it for much larger scattering lengths, just to show that this pseudopotential really captures things even if the scattering length is large. So I think this sort of addresses the question about the two-body problem. At least from an empirical perspective, we do reproduce the energy spectrum. And it is true that, you know, if you sort of, the energy dependence of these lower states is different from the energy dependence of these upper states, and if you now want to construct your complete set of states, there's a difficulty. I move on and discuss the three-body problem a little bit without energy dependence, and then we can maybe discuss how to bring in the energy dependence into that, which we haven't actually done. But what I do want to show, and this is still for just S-wave interacting systems, what I do want to show is that this pseudopotential approach can also be applied for more than two particles. And so what we did here is we just looked at three particles. So we have two identical fermions here interacting with a third particle, an impurity or a fermion of a different type. These all have the same masses. And the interaction is again through the S-wave pseudopotential. And then what we've looked at in this case is actually an anisotropic trap, so not a spherically symmetric trap. And then sort of going through the formalism, solving the Lippmann-Schwinger equation, what you get is the three-body energy spectrum. And this is how it looks like for three particles. So the first thing you notice is this is a mess, at least compared to the spectrum of two particles, right? There are a lot more states. And this is just sort of visually illustrating that three bodies are much richer than two bodies, sort of visually speaking. So what we have here is we used an aspect ratio of 2, so it's a slightly elongated trap. And for the quantum number in the row direction, sort of the projection quantum number, this is just the MS0 quantum number. So there's similar spectra for all the other quantum numbers, MS1, MS2, and MS3, and so on. But this is a good quantum number here. And then we have two different types of quantum numbers for the Z direction, positive parity and negative parity. And sort of just qualitatively, what you see is that there's sort of different types of curves here. There are these curves that I've marked by sort of in red. These are atom-atom-atom states. So in the trap, they don't form dimers or bound states. And then there are these other states here. And if we had shown the energy at more negative values, then clearly these are states where one dimer forms and then we have a third atom that's sort of moving relative to the dimer. But this is really a very dense spectrum, and so these trap states are very highly excited states in the system. But experimentally, it's really oftentimes these trap states that one would investigate.
So you are not yet using pseudopotential here.
No, this is pseudopotential. So I sort of skipped the math, but basically what we do is, you know, these are the pseudopotentials here between the particle 1 and 3 and 2 and 3. And then what we do is we basically solve the Lippmann-Schwinger equation. So I've just written down this form here. And then basically, what you can do is you plug these interactions into the Lippmann-Schwinger equation, and then because you use the zero-range pseudopotential, you can essentially do all the integrals analytically. So we sort of see, we use your two-body solution for the long...
I was asking because I have not seen it here, and so I was wondering what is in that.
No, we use that. So essentially at any...
Because you are elongated, right?
So yeah, so it's elongated, and to solve this problem, we basically use your two-body solution and then account for the third particle. So the mass is very nasty, and you know, I could
so you don't
put
have a particle 1 and 2 in front.
No, because these are identical fermions, and so in the low energy limit, the only way these two would be interacting is through p-wave interactions. And so what we're assuming is that we're actually away from a p-wave resonance in this case. So that's sort of one of these assumptions that we are working in the low energy, low scat, low temperature regime, and higher partial waves are suppressed. So this is the pseudopotential spectrum, and we have actually compared it with calculations for a finite range system, and that the agreement is pretty good. Okay.
Sorry, I don't want to slow you down too much, but still with this two-body thing, I'm a little confused with energy dependence and orthogonality. So you say there's no issue with two-body in the trap, and I agree the spectrum was beautiful. But are the eigenstates you get in that trap orthogonal? or because I would expect them not to be, since they're somehow solutions to different Hamiltonian speech changes.
Yeah.
And so if they're not orthogonal, then there must be physical properties that are different, even if the spectrum is right. Or maybe not, but that would be my...
Only you would calculate from the waveform.
Exactly.
Matrix
I calculated elements. Some matrix elements.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I mean, that, the energetics come out remarkably good, but not everything's going to come out correct. And so you kind of have to take that into account.
Yeah, I mean, formally you can certainly say, these states are not orthogonal. So that's very true because, I mean, we do use a different potential at for each excited state. And so very clearly there's not orthogonality. But in this case, we don't have, at least if you really just, say if I go. Sorry, if I go back here. So if we say we're really, just interested in, say, this point here and then the excited state here, and we're not sort of thinking about coupling these states in any way, then, in this case, the wave functions here are still a fairly good description and agree fairly well with the exact wave functions. And
the diagonal wave functions are still pretty good with the off-diagonal.
Yeah, I mean, if you solve the problem differently, sort of try to put in the energy dependence from the beginning, say, that might be a little bit different. Because here, we've really put it in, in a way, really after the fact, right? We say we have the eigenequation, we obtained that, no problem, everything was fine, we worked with, orthogonal states, and then we just, after the fact, ad hoc, put this in.
Or could I ask if we might be able to think about it this way? You mentioned how you could think of the pseudo-potential, energy-dependent pseudo-potential, as defining a boundary condition, a log derivative, which you might think is being imposed around the van der Waals length or something like that. So if you had some property that depended on the wave function outside that characteristic distance, beyond the distance where that boundary condition applies, then you might expect you're getting it quite well, even with the energy dependent pseudo-potential wave functions. But if it's defined inside that distance, then maybe we should forget it. You just can't do matrix elements. Is that a fair way of saying it?
I think that's a fair way, because a different way of actually deriving at eigenequations like this is really just sort of use, this is some work I did with Brian Granger, where we said we have an we have a K matrix that accounts for all the accumulation of the phase shift, and then we do a frame transformation that sort of projects the inner solution onto our outer solution, and then in the limit that we put the K matrix at R is equal to zero, we reproduce this result that, so I think what you're saying is true, and maybe sort of this frame transformation idea or a QDT framework is really eventually what makes this a bit more, if you want, rigorous.
I think that's exactly the point. That's why it works so nicely for two bodies. If you're just doing usual matching that you do for scattering, it's zero instead of some finite distance. But I think that also gives the insight of why it doesn't work so well for three body or more, because the matching isn't so simple then.
Yeah, and I think, again, the question of how to divide the energy is very inherently related to that question.
So that's what the first way of looking at it is, that this E is not a number, but an operator, an energy operator. And then you solve all the problems.
It doesn't solve all the problems.
Mm-hmm. I find that Nucia speaks about that, about what energy.
Yeah. So what I was referring to is that the energy that's k squared, and now thinking about this in terms of momentum, this basically translates into an operator like this. That's another way of thinking about it.
I think, imagine if you would take a real potential, not a pseudo potential, and this real potential does reproduce, for instance, this energy dependence that you want, and then that you don't put any energy dependent potential in here, but still, you have a model which has a short range potential and this long range threat, and that should give you proper eigenstates, which are all orthogonal, so give you the same spectrum. and the problem is solved. So indeed, what Paul was referring to, if you make a separation of the short range, and you, if you say, well, let me forget about everything at short range, I know that in a real system, I would have solutions there, which indeed give me the correct orthogonality, then at long range, everything should match up in the same way.
Sure, but you know, I think at some point, you know, you also, I mean, we can make the model more complicated and sort of say, yeah, you do the short range problem fully and then you get the full K matrix, and I fully agree with this. I think, you know, at some point you have to ask how useful is it, or how much physical insight do you get? And so the QDT sort of picture, I think, does provide a lot of insight.
Yeah. Well, when I'm using something like this, like an energy-dependent scattering length, then I always get a remark from people from many body physics and say, well, you know, we are okay if you use only a scattering length, but if you're going to use this energy dependence there, then it's not okay, because in many body systems, you can have things like off-diagonal scattering, like, and for that you need an off-the-energy shell T-metric.
Sure.
And that is something which is not included in this way, and maybe in some way should be included to describe something beyond two body.
I agree.
Just one comment following up on your comments, Servos and Brett's, that in practice I think what people in the three-body community do is to use real short-range potentials, but maybe a potential that only supports one bound state or two bound states or three bound states, instead of, say, the real potential might have 70 or 100. So in effect, you can actually get an awful lot of the three-body physics out of potentials that support just a few bound states, and then you enforce orthogonality between all the states in the system that
Then you don't have to, right?
So in a certain sense, you can. That's kind of like another kind of pseudo-potential, I mean, where you just
It's a low-energy approximation, because we rely on universality and your threshold to be able to do that.
So in a sense, it's extending the pseudo-potential idea to...
Sure.
I mean, just, you know, the idea of using separable potentials also comes in here, right? Because that's also a low energy approach, and then, you know, that
space,
that's sort of maybe halfway in between this pseudo potential approach and using the two body potential that only supports one or two bound states.
Sure. And the disadvantage, though, is that we still have to do everything numerically with regards to pseudo potentials. A lot can be done.
Yeah. I mean, just.
So, what about the similar experience, just taking a two channel model? There's still a lot to be done. Do you guys ever do that?
Sure.
Yeah, so.
Your range of pseudo
potentials. Yeah. So for two part, So for two particles, the coupled channel model with pseudo potential, that's been worked out. You know, there are many groups that have done that. Chris and I and Josh have worked on that. Josh Dunn. But there are really many groups that have worked that out. For the three-body problem, Seth Rittenhouse did a little bit with sort of coupled channels, and...
Efimov did.
Yeah, so again, there's a host of people who've done that. But I think this energy dependent, you know, how to do that, or how, maybe ask the question, how to extend the validity regime of the pseudo-potential beyond zero energy. That problem, I would say, is not yet fully solved. So that's probably the most general way of phrasing the problem.
So is this result fully analytic then?
Well, I mean, fully analytic is, all the matrix elements are analytic, and then this is sort of obtained by diagonalizing a 200 by 200 or 600 by 600 matrix, but the matrix elements themselves are analytic. And, you know, the nice thing in this approach is that these atom-atom-atom states are actually converging very nicely. And, you know, these states, if we use the 1,000 by 1,000 matrix, you know, these states may move a little bit, but we're not that, I mean, that's just a forest of diving states, right? But these are actually very well described. And if we, you know, when we use finite range potentials and try to do something like this, it actually gets quite tricky because we have to say we want the eigenenergy in a particular energy window, and then you know, we have to work pretty hard. And here, it sort of comes out naturally in a certain way.
Mm-hmm. Just a quick technical question: you're using the oscillator states as the basis here when you say 200 by 200 or 1000 by 1000.
Yeah, so we do expand in terms of the harmonic oscillator states, but the thing is that basically the two-body solution comes in exactly. So if you work it out, so essentially you have sort of the formation of the dimer described exactly within this model, and then you sort of look, essentially you account for the exchange effects brute force by saying that you can't have just these two particles form a dimer, but you can also have this other up particle form a dimer with this one. And that's the effect that why we need 200 basis functions, or you know, 200 by 200 matrix. That's sort of the easy way to think about it. But it's, you know, 200 by 200, this is pretty small, right? Then.
So is your wave function then just a slight determinant of for these three particles, or?
It's a dumb question.
No, it's not just a slight determinant, no. I can write it out, but
the correlations
are fully in there. So it's not just the simple.
It is anti-symmetrized.
And it's properly anti-symmetrized.
It has more.
Yeah, but it's.
How would you change correlatively if you vary the aspect ratio?
I can show you, but it's probably on slide 100 or something from an old talk. But essentially what you see is sort of, you can maybe see it here, that these two diving states sort of show up a little bit in pairs. So these two come in a pair and these two come in a pair. And that's related to the fact that's an aspect ratio too. So you do see the fact that in this case you have sort of two states before the next transverse mode becomes available. But I mean, if you stared, you know, I would have to look for 2 minutes to tell you what aspect ratio it is. So qualitatively it would look very similar. So maybe I skip this, but you can also do things in 1D, and in 1D you can even do it for four particles very nicely. And one of the things that we looked at in this case is really look at this repulsive branch. So this would be the repulsive crossover branch of the three-body and four-body systems for two-component Fermi gases. And we really see very nice correlations if you look at, say, the up-up or the up-down distance in terms of what happens when the interactions are being cranked up. But of course 1D is very simple because you don't need a regularization. So this is one thing that I definitely sort of want to discuss a little bit. So if you now go back and say we don't use the regularization operator of the pseudopotential, and we do something very simple, which is we use the Hartree wave function. So it's just a product of single particle wave function. Here we use the non-regularized three-dimensional pseudopotential. When then goes through the mass, what you get is simply the Gross-Pitevsky equation, right? So of course this is not a surprise, but so what this is also telling us is that there's this connection from the pseudopotential to many-body physics. Of course this is just the simplest version here. And if you have this, then you know one thing that Brett did in 97 is to sort of say, well, if you have this formalism, we can really use the technology from new chemical physics and sort of do RPA and then everything else that one can do with the many-body system. So. It was a fairly long introduction, but I think it sort of set the stage for discussing pseudopotentials for dipoles. And to start this, I want to start very simply and sort of stick with this non-regularized pseudopotential. So we have the contact interaction here, and then we have the dipole-dipole interaction here. And this is something I think that was introduced by
Ian.
And so here, this is the piece that we discussed before. And this is the long-range dipole-dipole interaction. As written, both of these pieces would lead to divergencies, the first discussed, and the second one, well, if you take this distance here to R0, you have a 1 over R cubed divergence, and that also, you know, you'd think gives you problems. So the one important aspect is, if you use this pseudopotential in a Gross-Pitevsky framework, then this S-wave scattering length is really determined by an interplay between short-range physics and long-range physics. And so the first question that we sort of ask is, well, if you have a pseudopotential like this, does it work? So what I mean by this is, if you write down the Gross-Pitevsky equation, does this give you the right results?
You're thinking about no regularization here at the Gross-Pitevsky level?
No regularization. You know, so why might you think, you know, it worked in the S-wave case, right? Why should it not work? Well, this is long range. You know, it's not as long range as, say, Coulomb interaction, but still, right? But then you might also say, well, you know, it should work, because even in the case of Coulomb interaction, if you look at the descriptions, say, in solids, people use a screen Coulomb interaction and then replace that by a delta function interaction, and everything works again to some degree. So I think there are sort of reasons to think it would work, it would not work. This is just the Gross-Pitevsky equation, so it's now an integral differential equation. But that can be solved very efficiently, as been done by many people. So what our goal was to start with is to say, well, let's actually look at, in this case, a many-body Schrödinger equation that has some sort of realistic model interaction. What we call realistic here is we basically take a hard wall, so a cutoff, and then we take the dipole-dipole interaction. So what we do is we take this model interaction, we do the coupled channel scattering calculation. That gives us the S-wave scattering lengths here to put into the GP equation. And then we compare the result of the GP equation with the many-body solution for that model potential that has the hard wall in it. And this is the result we find. So this is for 10 particles under spherically symmetric confinement. This is where we put the hard wall here at that value B. And what you can see is the energy per particle as a function of the dipole length. So it's basically just the mass times the dipole moment squared over h bar squared. What you see is that these are the blue symbols, those are the DMC results. And then we have two types of Gross-Pitevsky equation results, green and red, and they essentially agree. So what we've done here is, the red results here are for the true thing. This is what you should be doing when you solve the Gross-Pitevsky equation. So we take the S-wave scattering length, which depends on the dipole moment, and we include the long-range piece. But then this green solution here simply neglects the dipole-dipole interaction and just takes the contact interaction. And you see that, at least in the accuracy considered here, the difference is tiny. So you can't actually see, at least in these calculations, the dipole-dipole interaction. To really see the effect of the dipole-dipole interaction, you have to look at structural properties, and that's what we're doing here. So it's the same type of calculations. we now look at the size of the system in the x direction and the z direction. So for the DMC, the many body calculations, this is what we find. And then if we use the Gross-Bethievsky equation without the angle dependent piece, of course, we just see an isotropic system, that's the green line. But if we do, just one second, if we do include the long range piece, we do see that the Gross-Bethievsky equation actually does account for the deformation of the trap properly. And so at this level, I would argue that we've sort of confirmed the validity of the mean field treatment.
So how are you choosing the contact part? I mean, I would think that somehow this result depends on how large or small that piece is.
So what we really do is we take this modeled potential, which has the cutoff and the dipole-dipole potential. We do a couple channel calculation, and that gives us the strength of the contact potential. So along this curve, the strength of the contact potential is actually changing. So we do a...
So you're keeping the radius of that hard wall fixed?
Exactly.
The depth of the dipole-dipole piece?
Yeah, the dipole-dipole potential.
The radius of that hard wall where maybe one would become more important?
Actually, for this model that we are using, the relevant quantity is really the dipole length divided by RC. So there's one dimensionless parameter.
Okay,
and then,
making a dimensionless parameter out of D over A H O, right? So it seems like dimensionless parameters.
That's true. So in our calculation, we basically keep RC over A H O fixed, and we do change the strength of the dipole. So we make the potential deeper. If you want.
So at least logically it would be possible that the long range interaction is shows more of a deviation from this contact if I change AC over H or what if you call it RC over AH. Right?
Yeah, I mean.
You've never seen this or you haven't?
Well, they're technical problems. So we can't make the potential very, very deep and still do the many body calculations. And that's a technical difficulty with these Monte Carlo calculations. So we're somewhat limited to this small dipole regime. We would love to go to strong dipoles, but it's very difficult because then you have many body bound states in the problem and we don't know how to get rid of them. It's very hard to get rid of them in the Monte Carlo calculations.
RC is your cut parameter?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, RC is the same as... Sorry about that. That's the same as B, so it's the hard wall.
That's the hard wall.
Yeah.
And is the only attractive potential or only potential the dipole, or do you put in a van der Waals tail?
No, in this case, we only use the dipolar interaction.
Just the dipole.
So
do you have any thoughts about the role of the van der Waals length or the scale length of the van der Waals potential, or would you basically even keep the dipole length small compared to that for if we try to simulate something more realistic, or if you...
I mean, I think at the end, we really need that the RC is reasonably small compared to this, and also that the dipole length is reasonably small compared to the oscillator length. And so just qualitatively, I would say, we would also need that the van der Waals length should be small in some sense compared to the oscillator length.
You don't have a necessary criteria though of D star and van der Waals length.
No, yeah. We've not been able to get a handle on that.
So basically, qualitatively again, your idea is I have the pseudo potential, I have the dipole part, and I have basically a dipole dependent scattering length for the pseudo potential part. This is how I should understand it. And the way you relate those is just via this, you know, numerical sort of calculation for each possible values of the dipole.
Yeah. Okay. So it's really just doing the couple channel calculation. So this is sort of for the shape-dependent pseudo-potential. And now you might say, well, let's go one step further and try to think, is there a zero-range pseudo-potential? So the whole the 1 over r cubed behavior is going to be eliminated, and instead we put contact interactions that lead to scattering into and out of each partial wave. And such a pseudopotential was proposed by Andrei Derevyanko in 2003. It looks a little bit scary, I guess. But I think the basic idea is very simple. We sort of have this pseudopotential. It's a sum over all possible partial wave combinations of incoming and outgoing wave. And each of these pieces of the pseudopotential sort of has the typical three parts. There's sort of a regularizing part that looks very nasty and long in this case. There's the piece that makes it a contact interaction, and there's the strength of that pseudopotential that tells you if you come in a given partial wave, how strongly do you get scattered out. Now, in principle, this means that we really have an infinite number of coupling constants that go into this pseudopotential, and that might mean, you know, that's not very useful, right? We have an infinite number of parameters. But then it was also suggested that these coupling strengths, which again depend on the scattering lengths, that they might actually be able to simply approximate it using the Born approximation. And the essence of that idea is that each of the scattering lengths here for the different partial wave channels is simply proportional to the dipole lengths, this proportionality factors that are known analytically. So in this sense, this gets back to what we had before, in that there's a dipole length, and then the A00 would have to be treated separately. That's a parameter that cannot be determined within the Born approximation. So if we do this and just again look at this model potential that we had with the hard wall, this is what you see for the A00 as a function of changing this ratio between D star and RC. And you actually do see the A20 and the A22, they follow very nicely a straight line. So this is the Born approximation value. There's a couple of very, very narrow spikes that show up when the S wave scattering length goes through a resonance. So this Born approximation seems to be okay as long as you're far away from resonance. And I may add, as long as your scattering energy is roughly below the energy scale associated with the dipole lengths. So this is for a particular potential. These are just the scattering lengths as a function of scattering energy. And if you, for example, look at the scattering lengths A02 or A20, it follows the Born approximation value, this red line, fairly nicely, but then eventually it really deviates, and this is where the scattering lengths, the scattering energy sort of becomes of the order of the dipole energy. So there are limitations to the Born approximation, of course, but it works reasonably well. So now what you can do, go pretty quickly, what you can do is you can take Andre's pseudopotential and you use that to describe the interaction between two particles in a spherically symmetric trap. And after a bunch of math, you come up with an eigenequation that looks a little bit more complicated than before. But if you plot the resulting two-body energies and you compare that to full calculations for the model potential, you see nice agreement. So this is the two-body energy. The zero-range pseudopotential energies are shown by these crosses. This is for two identical bosons. And the solid lines here are for that finite range potential that has the hard wall with the dipole-dipole interaction. So this looks pretty nice. If you zoom in a little bit, you see that even these crossings or near-avoided crossings are fairly well described by the pseudopotential. You see a little bit of deviations here. And then if you sort of crank up the dipole lengths a little bit here, so this is going to 0.3 in units of the oscillator lengths, and you choose the depths of your comparison potential in such a way that the zero energy scattering lengths in the S-wave channels is zero, then your zero energy pseudopotential predicts this. The model potential predicts these red crosses, and if we include the energy dependence in the pseudopotential, we actually get, again, fairly good agreement. So I would argue that probably this pseudopotential works fairly well as long as the D star over the oscillator lengths is somewhat smaller than one, sort of similar to what we found before. The van der Waals lengths should be smaller than the oscillator lengths. So this all looks good, but there are problems. The problems are the following. If we actually look at the eigenequation that we derived, it's something I didn't show you, we do find unphysical roots in the low energy regime, and we do not know at this point how to get rid of them. If we sort of create a model that's not 1 over r cubed, but 1 over r to the 5 or 1 over r to the 6, but we keep the angular dependent piece, this is not physics, this is a model to test if our math is right, then we don't have these unphysical roots. So we think there's probably something going on with the way the threshold laws are encaptured in the pseudopotential. If we do go to an anisotropic confinement, using a lot of the work that's been done by Ciacek and Tommaso Colarco, then we get a lot more of these unphysical roots. And again, we have no idea of how to get rid of them. And this is work that we never published because, well, we have unphysical behavior that we do not know how to get rid of. But I do think that there's probably something in the pseudopotential in the low energy regime that we are missing that is somehow, when the scattering energy goes to zero, something is not captured properly. Of course, you know, we may have just made a lot of stupid mistakes. I can't rule that out, but we tried our best to check things. So I leave this up just for thought. Thank you.
I'm very sorry that we give you more on physical rules, of course. But how many more?
You know, at some point we found so many that we gave up. No, it depends.
Okay.
So it depends a little bit on the aspect ratio that we're looking at. So that, you know, in this aspect ratio of 1, we had 1 unphysical root that for the cases we looked at. And that we couldn't, you know, we were hoping it would go away if we include the energy dependence, sort of similar to what one would see in the P-wave case, but that didn't happen. I do not remember how the number of unphysical roots, say, scales with the aspect ratio or any of that.
So I'm just wondering here if you are familiar with this work of Ludovic Prokopenko, I think. That he, I think some of the things that he was doing to include the energy dependence on this zero model is kind of redefining this hard problem by relating it to this molecular problem. I need to dig deeper and try to understand what the board is. I was curious if you
Yeah.
If you know how to connect with the thing that he was doing into this problem that we're talking about.
Yeah, so we haven't tried to directly apply sort of some of the work that he's done for P-wave interactions to our case. And maybe, you know, I should also point out that you've been thinking a little bit about pseudopotentials for dipoles, and you had some ideas on maybe how to deal with the threshold behavior, so that possibly there's something there.
I'm kind of bypassing all these more orthogonality issues.
Yeah.
There was something there. I don't know what's the effect.
Yeah, so. Basho was pointing at me.
Yeah. So I'm going to go this way and then.
I have a question. So those of diagonal scattering lengths, they are defined in terms of the K-matrix. So it is a certain limit of the K-matrix. And I guess, I mean, what. Part of what you have shown is that basically if you take that E and U approximation, so like the contact part, and then on top of that if you have this dipole piece, it works as long as the Born approximation for those of diagonal scattering lengths work, right? But what happens if the Born approximation doesn't work? So if you have some resonances, and in fact you can have some resonances, I mean we have discussed the cycle a little bit. So if you, for example, are in some trap, and of course you have some relative energies, then like you were discussing this SK dependence, right? So then your K matrix is going to depend on K, and also the Born approximation is not going to work. So the point is that then if the Born approximation no longer works, then this original E and U approximation is no longer there. Okay. So the point is that so maybe there is this extreme case, right? Maybe it's useful to consider is when the Born approximation is not there.
Yeah, but I mean, I agree with you, but our expectation was sort of that we do account for the energy dependence, which we did here. So we, you know, just say take the full K matrix with the full energy dependence and put that into the pseudopotential. Then we at least thought that qualitatively things should work really well, and sort of an unphysical route is really something that's, you know, qualitatively off. So if we had used just the Born approximation values, I'd agree with you, but since we did include the energy dependence, I sort of expected that things should still work, but maybe that's something to discuss a little bit more as well. We should make sure that Shandana gets to start at 11, so that sort of she also gets to talk.
Yes, I think maybe we'll do one more question and then.
Thank you. That's very simple. Again, to this anisotropic companion. You try also to use, because above you say if you use only L equals 0 or L equal 1 part of the potential, it looks better. Have you tried also to use our P wave solution for the anisotropic case? And you get the same problem.
No. So if we only use the, so if we say, you know, the bound states are really determined for the even L by L0 and the odd L case by LS1, if we just use that, things are described qualitatively correctly, and we do not
also
have
in the anisotropic case.
Also in the anisotropic case. So that's all fine. So it's very clear that the problems arise somehow from the coupling to the higher angular momentum channels. So that we've established, and we've also established at least with some tests that if we make sort of a mock short-range potential that couples all the partial waves, that our eigen equations do work.
Okay.
Okay. As far as we can test it. So.
And if you use, because you can do slope tensions for the higher partial waves, right? You can.
Mm-hmm. We reproduce all of that. Our diagonal pseudo potential, it reproduces that. So if we turn off the off diagonals, we reproduce everything that you've done, and D wave and G wave. I mean, that we've all tested, and there are no problems there.
So it's like probably the anisotropy of the dipole, which is really giving rise to this.
Yeah, so it's somehow the coupling.
The anisotropy of the confinement, then this is a mess.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's thank Dora then for...